I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from San Luis Obispo, California. Come along and join me for a fascinating telephone conversation with Victoria Newhouse in New York City. Victoria is a renowned architectural historian, and her writings have appeared in the New York Times, Architectural Digest, and numerous other publications. Victoria is also the author of numerous books, including the recently published Parks of the 21st Century, Reinvented Land, Reclaimed Territories. Victoria Newhouse, you have no idea how exciting it is to talk to you. I was frankly blown away by your book, Parks of the 21st Century.
Oh, well, that's very nice to hear.
Yeah, for a lot of different reasons. One is that I've been to a lot of the parks that you write about, spent a lot of time in China. But I'd like to start back in time with you. How did your life journey progress? You went to Bryn Mawr. As I recall, you were a French major.
That's correct, yes.
So what happened? What was the shift? How did you get an interest in architecture?
Well, when I got out of college, I started working in publishing. I was living at that time in France, and I was evaluating material that came into Gallimard, the French publisher. I was evaluating it for translation into English. That's really how I started off in publishing. Then I eventually came back to New York and went to work as a full-time editor for George Braziller. And as you know, I'm sure, his prime interest was in architecture. So I eventually worked my way up to become his architecture editor, for which I realized I needed some training, because at that point, when he offered me that job, I had no background in architecture. So I got a master's degree in architectural history at Columbia.
So you got the bug. Something resonated with you big time.
That's right.
And then you started the Architecture History Foundation. Tell us about that, when that happened, and why you did that.
The reason I did it was it happened, I guess it was in the 1980s, discovered that even very, very renowned scholars, like, for example, Henry Russell Hitchcock, who I had met, and I had read many of his books and his articles, and I discovered that it shocked me, which was that his most recent book, which was on Netherlandish architecture, was turned down by the publisher. I think he had a scholarly publisher somewhere out in the Midwest. I don't remember exactly the name, but, you know, they pleaded being too poor, that they were, you know, that things were very, very slow in publishing, which was very true at the time. So I got together a group of friends. Actually, the prime among that group was Edgar Kaufman Jr., the son of the man who built Falling Water with Frank Lloyd Wright.
Wow, that's really cool. One of my favorite projects.
Yes, it's a wonderful building. He joined me in putting together some money, together with, we did also some fundraising, to be able to publish works like Henry Russell Hitchcock, for which there was no longer either a trade or a university press publisher. And that was the Architectural History Foundation.
And that continues today or no?
Well, no, we no longer publish. At that time, during those 10 years, we actually published the books. I had a production editor, and she was very experienced in book production. And so we actually produced the books. They were distributed by MIT Press. But then what happened in the early 90s, things began to change, and we suddenly realized that we were competing with scholarly presses. So there was not much point in doing that, since there was already somebody in place willing now to publish this kind of book. It still exists, but we no longer publish books. We give small donations to people writing books, usually about $5,000 to help them put together their illustrations.
That's really cool. Back in time, at some point, you became involved with the Pritzker Prize. How did that happen?
Well, I know a great many architects. I mean, through my work, I had met many, many architects, and especially since I never write about a building without visiting it. So, and just through word of mouth, somebody suggested that I would make a good addition to the jury of the Pritzker Prize. I served on it for 3 years.
That's flattering. That's really cool. Let's roll forward. At some point, you decided to write this book, Parks of the 21st Century. Was the seed, the germination, that you were traveling around the world and encountering these parks, and then you had an epiphanous moment where you went, oh my gosh, let's put the whole compendium together as a book?
I think it was the other way around.
Oh.
I got the idea of writing the book because I had just written a chapter about a new park in Athens in the cultural center designed by Renzo Piano, which was almost a billion-dollar project, including an opera house and a concert hall and a park. So when it came to my chapter that I had to write about the park, I had to do some research because that is not my field. And I became completely fascinated with the subject of landscape.
Interesting. So then that's the point when you thought you would put it together as a book?
That's correct.
Okay. And so then you had to travel around the world, correct?
Well, yes. I worked with a professional landscape architect, Alex Pischer, and what we would do is we would research new parks. We only, as you know from looking at the book, we only discussed parks of the last 20 years. So we would research them online, and then when we found parks that corresponded to our interests, which were, first of all, a beautiful park, and then secondly, a park that made some sort of contribution to the environment in terms of water control or water purification or whatever, we would then travel to see the park. And we very soon discovered all of these parks in China, which we were just totally entranced by. We thought they were all so beautiful.
One thing that came to mind was Frederick Law Olmsted was the seminal park builder in the 19th century. How has his projects held up over the time?
Well, I think they've held up very, very well. And I think they are still an inspiration for many ideas. Like, for example, his famous Emerald Necklace in Boston, which is a series of parks that are connected to one another. That is an idea that has been adopted more and more in recent years in many, many different cities in different countries, of a connection between park. I think even back then, when he did the Emerald Necklace in Boston in the late 19th century, he was very, very interested in water management, and that is also a big, big issue in parks today. So
he really was a futurist visionary then.
Yes.
Interesting. And I noticed that some of the parks that you feature in the book, like you said, they are the little string of pearls, the necklace. It appears that that's out of geographic default. You know, you have these gaps in this land form, right?
That's right.
Interesting. If you had to sum it up, if you had to choose one of the parks you visited, could you choose a favorite?
Well, I loved the park in Manchuria, Changzheng. It was actually started by the Japanese at the time that they were occupying that area. I found that was a very, very beautiful park that is partly self-propagating. It's partly vegetation that was on that site when they started to create this water purification plant there, and then partly new material. And
What I loved about your focus on northern China, I've been there too, in the former Manchuria area, Dalian and whatnot. And I was so happy that you talked about the Japanese architecture that remains. You know, at first sight, it's a disconnect until you remember. But you shared that fascination, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And then you have the layered on Russian foreboding architecture in places like Dalian. But anyway, we're getting off track from parks. In Europe, one of the most intriguing destinations that you wrote about that was such a disconnect was Oerlikon Park near Zurich. That was interesting. Didn't you find that distinctively unique?
Yes, absolutely. Very, very interesting, very unusual, and very seductive. Walking, as I said in the book, walking up those flights of different levels in that steel structure that they created.
Okay, so that's a new creation. That wasn't the skeleton of the former industrial manufacturing.
No, it was new. It was new.
Was it designed to pay homage to that previous incarnation, or was it?
Well, I think so. I think there's a connection. I think they had that in mind when the architects designed it. And one of the lovely things about visiting that park is, you know, it has become a favorite place for birds. There are many, many different bird species who have made their nests there and are flying in and out. And, of course, the scents, the odors of all of those different flowers is wonderful. So it's really a multiple sensory experience going through it.
Give us a quick word picture of the climbing vines. I found that most fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not a landscape architect.
I know, but just as a visual experience, you know.
Well, you know, it's very beautiful and very intriguing to have these plants that are all vertical, very, very much vertical, rather than spread out horizontally along the ground. And it's very fascinating. Both Alex, who helped me with the book, and myself, we were both really very intrigued by the whole thing.
And that it was truly a unique expression, right?
Well, I've never encountered anything like it. Have you?
No. That's why I was double fascinated.
Yeah.
One of the things that you talk about in a lot of your projects, China specifically, East Coast in America, has to do with mitigating polluted industrial sites. But equally important is efforts to protect from flooding.
Yes.
And one aside in that curiosity is, how are they addressing the rising sea levels, you know, planning for the next 100 years? Did you encounter that?
Well, you must have had quite a bit of experience with that out in California, because one of the future projects is, of course, the Los Angeles River and the enormous effort that is being made now to try and correct mistakes that were made in the past. And one of the major problems with that river is flooding, and that has, you know, killed people and created hundreds of millions of dollars of damage. So what is interesting about the approach to solving this problem of flooding is that instead of encasing a riverbed in cement the way that was done in the 1930s for the Los Angeles River, now there's a much more naturalistic approach to flooding, which is to allow flooding to happen, but also to create an environment where the water can recede. So it's allowed to come in, but it's also allowed to go out, to recede when the flood hits, you know, its highest point.
Right. That's fascinating. And how about building the sites higher to allow for the future eventuality of sea level rise? Did anybody talk about that, address that?
Not really, no. I know they've done that to a certain extent in Holland, but so much has been written about flood control in Holland that we decided that we weren't going to add to what it was already there. So that's not really something, I'm sorry, I don't know much about that.
But it's definitely something that needs to be addressed, correct?
Yes, I would think so.
One of the other elements that I was fascinated by, for example, in the Shanghai Park across from the Bund, you talk about how they built wind funnels that served to cool the adjacent area. Talk about that. That's fascinating.
Yes, that's right. They created areas that would be hospitable to the prevailing winds, to, as you say, to cool off specific districts in the very hot months. And in fact, that goes back to Olmsted, if you like, in a sense, and the Emerald Necklace, that Shanghai is now surrounded by its own necklace of parks and environmentally oriented creations.
And again, this is a little off track. Like I said, I spent a lot of time in China up until COVID. And wherever I traveled were the high-rise buildings that you talked about. And they're empty. They're not inhabited. And then you addressed how they built these parks around these new high-rise complexes, but nobody lives there. Talk about that for a moment. That's
the ghost towns. I think they're referred to as ghost towns. And, I mean, everything is controlled by the government in China, of course. And the idea was housing that would improve on what people had in their old-fashioned low-rise buildings. But it hasn't really worked out. We encountered a cab driver in one city who said that he had bought one of these apartments, and he sold it with such a considerable profit a few years later that it gave him enough money to send both of his sons to college in the United States. But not everybody has been that lucky. I think lots of people have... I think one of the big problems I gathered just from what we learned when we were traveling there is that not all of these areas with these high rises are near to places where people can get jobs and support themselves. So how can people move to an area without some means of support? You know, it's very, very difficult.
And that being said, you talked about these new beautiful parks built adjacent to the ghost high rises. And there, you went to one and you were the only people there.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So that's an interesting disconnect.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Another dynamic that is intriguing to me is the funding for these new environmental remediation parks. And you addressed a couple where everything started out great, but there was a gap in maintenance and upkeep. And then you talk about how an ongoing programming of events and whatnot is a great way to funnel money for upkeep. Talk to us about that for a moment.
In China, of course, everything is paid for by the government, but China seems to suffer from the same problem that we encountered in many, many other countries, which is that the money up front to build the park is there, but then once it's built, nobody seems to be interested in providing the money for the maintenance. And it's a problem everywhere, and certainly in China. I mean, many of the small pavilions and the walkways and other small structures in the Chinese parks we found very neglected because they simply had not been maintained. And that's, you know, it's hard to understand how that happens in a country that has the wealth that China has. Here in the United States, of course, most parks were a combination of private donations and some money from the city. So it's easier to understand that it's hard to always have the money to always be able to raise the money for maintenance. But it's harder to understand how that happens in China.
But you talked about some parks have done a great job of doing concerts and events and whatnot to serve as a financial infusion.
Yes, well, that's very true. This kind of highline wannabe in Chicago, the 606, which is exactly the same idea as our highline here in Manhattan, an elevated railroad that has been abandoned and which is now a park. And we met the young woman there who is in charge of programming, and she had something programmed for absolutely every single day of the year in that park. Much of it is free, but then some of it you have to pay for. And, of course, it's a wonderful fundraiser.
That's interesting. And then you talked about a city or region envisions a park, and then it's kind of figured out by committee where they want to open up to the community and whatnot. And reading that, it's almost like a miracle that any of the projects happen because you have all that infighting and different visions and whatnot.
That's why it takes so long to make a park in the United States because of all that infighting. I mean, again, to go back to China, which is the absolutely opposite situation where everything is just defined by the government, whether people want it or not. But they make a park there in about, I would say, one half or maybe even less time than it takes us, because they just go ahead. They don't talk to anybody.
Well, I think it was in China where you talked about the project where the government came in and first built the seawall, which really upset the designer because it kind of locked him into stuff that, you know, blocked what he wanted to do.
That's correct. That's in Shanghai. And the designer happened to be American, so it was quite a surprise for him to find this wall already in place.
And that's an example of that autocratic bureaucracy of Chinese government policy. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, once again, let's talk about Novartis in Basel. That's really interesting. Tell us about what most intrigued you about the Novartis site.
Well, it was very interesting. We had seen a number of parks that were almost completely self-perpetuating, like the one just outside Paris in the suburbs there, that's devoted to the study of insects. And so it was amusing for us to find this area that was so completely controlled. I mean, absolutely, every blade of grass practically was controlled. And, you know, it's a phenomena. It's, for us, it was a discovery. We had never been on a campus like that with no cars, very, very quiet and peaceful. It's a very scholarly atmosphere, and of course that's appropriate since they have a lot of scientists working there on their different chemicals and medications that they produce there.
And so that park is funded by Novartis?
Yes, completely. Well, you know, they have a great deal of money. They're extremely wealthy.
And then you talked about another corporate model park, I think in Seattle, that was really interesting.
Uh-huh.
The one you were talking about was the travel one.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. They are right on the water there. It's very, very beautiful views. And it very generously decided to share the waterfront with the public. I mean, they didn't have to do that. That land all belongs to them. But they made this decision that they would create a public park there. And it is very lovely, very, very nice.
And as long as we're talking about Seattle, I used to live in the San Juan Islands, spent a lot of time in Seattle, and I was most impressed. Gas Works Park, you were one of the early ones. Talk to us about that. That's a brilliant concept.
He was one of the first, that designer was one of the first people to leave all the industrial remains, so to speak, in the park that he designed. And that has really been a model for so many other parks. There's a whole area of Germany in the Ruhr Valley where the architects have done the same thing. They've actually gone one step further because they left not only the machinery, but they left actually some of the industrial buildings that are now used for cultural activities.
Oh, interesting. And then dovetailing back to China and the Shanghai parks, the same thing you talked about, where the cranes were left in place.
That whole idea was much longer in being accepted in China. At first, the government actually opposed that idea. Some of the more adventurous landscape architects in China had raised the possibility of doing this, and they were turned down because the government didn't understand the idea. But then, you know, through repetition and through insisting on the benefits of doing this, it has now become a fairly common practice.
That's really cool. What I was alluding to back in Seattle was also where they capped the freeway and made a park on top of the freeway. That's a great, great concept. Talk to us about freeway capping projects.
Well, that's something that's going on all over the world today. I think people have become less and less accepting of busy highways that are noisy and rather smelly. And I think more and more there's a request for doing something about them. And one of the more popular approaches to addressing this problem is to cap them.
And also, if you think about it, you don't have raw land to build a park. So it's like this double bonus.
That's right.
And then I love in Europe where they make the little capped freeway parks for animals to get across the freeway. That's really cool.
Yes, that was in Holland. That was very nice.
Talk to us about, let's go sideways for a moment. You wrote a book, Sight and Sound Relationship in Architecture and Acoustics.
Yes.
Talk to us about that for a moment.
Well, that was about concert halls and opera houses. And it was inspired mainly by Frank Gehry's wonderful concert hall in Los Angeles, Disney Hall. There, again, I became, I think every time I've written a book, it's been partly to learn, so that I could learn something about the subject I'm writing about.
What did you find most fascinating about the concert halls relative to acoustics?
Well, how difficult it is to get it right. How really, it's really a challenge.
I was at one, I think Kansas City, and the acoustician built this little baby model, perfect, of the whole concert hall with little people in it and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And then did testing, and that's how they kind of figured out the mistakes ahead of time.
Yes, I think that's a very common practice now.
Yeah, it makes sense, even economics. Tell us a little bit more before we go. What's closest to your heart, where you're going now, and what you're envisioning for the future?
Well, I've changed gears completely, so to speak, and I'm responding to this terrible situation that we now have in the United States and around the world, which is a lack of proper housing. Together with an architect friend of mine, we have put together a series of articles by people who are experts in their various fields about affordable housing and how we can do something to improve the situation. So we have chapters, for example, on materials that are being used now. One of the most interesting innovations in materials today is timber, which is now a composite made with some artificial materials. And people are going up higher than they have ever gone before, historically, with timber buildings that are now 10 stories, 10 floors high, and sometimes even higher. So we're hoping that, you know, innovations like that can contribute to the problem of affordable housing.
That's really cool. And so this is a book project that is in process?
It is. It will be published by Rizzoli next year.
And the title, do you have a title yet?
We don't have a definite title. We're thinking of calling it Affordable, within in parentheses, question mark, and then Housing.
That's really cool. And I think another place I'd like to delve is fireproof construction.
Yes, well, these timber buildings are fireproof, interestingly enough. I mean, there was a long time prejudice about building in timber because people thought that it was too dangerous in terms of fire. But now that has all changed. And in fact, these new buildings have been proven to be more fireproof than steel.
You know, I have a book that I studied in college about engineering and architecture, and they showed this building that burnt down, and it had big glulam beams, and above that were I-beams of steel. And the steel I-beams were like wet noodles draped over the glulam wood beams.
So there you go.
Yeah, I should send you that picture. That's a great one.
I'd love to have it.
Well, you know what, Victoria? I could go on and on forever with you, and I really appreciate the time. This has been an honor and a pleasure. So we'll do a part two next year when your new book comes out.
Oh, great. I look forward to it.
Me too. Victoria Newhouse, thank you so much. What an honor and a pleasure to visit.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted. I have enjoyed our talk very much.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.